Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to the KC2RC repeater system.
This is AC2GS. The Kings County Radio Club's technical net will begin in 5 minutes.
AC2ZV.
Yes, I hear you, William.
Great. I'm down here working in my lab, and I'm checking in over Echolink, so I'll be your partner over Echolink tonight.
Okay. It should work just as well this way. Fortunately, everything seems to be working with Echolink, so that shouldn't be a problem.
Okay. Meanwhile, I'll think of some nice, juicy questions for you if nobody chimes in. Talk to you soon. Over.
Welcome, everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County. I am still on. That's good. I am Roy AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and William AC2ZV will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, and we also offer original articles and reviews on many topics that are covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com, and we also have an Echolink node available for use. Just point your Echolink application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. And I will try to provide a cogent answer, and William AC2ZV will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for further topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, William AC2ZV. Good evening, William.
This is AC. Well, we had a day. I'm down here in the shop playing at sorting out adapters, so that's my exciting evening for working with you and working with electronics. So I'll talk to you later about the 10-meter net if you want. I had some interesting comments about that. So back to net control.
Okay, very good, William. Well, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if there are people out there with any either questions or comments to be made, please feel free, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, it looks... Let's see here. Yeah, okay. There's a little kind of a glitch where it kind of drops it the first time for some strange reason. Don't quite know. I'll figure out eventually. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS. My name continues to be Roy. This continues to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, and we're having kind of a slow start up today. Not uncommon for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Most people tend to show up a wee bit on the late side. But nevertheless, we're here, and so if anyone is out there and they've tuned up their little radios and they have a question or a comment to make, once again, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
AC2ZV.
Yes, William.
Well, I just want to talk to you about the 10-meter net, first of all. I tried to tune in to the 10-meter net, and I didn't hear anything. It was just like totally dead. I thought maybe my antenna had fallen down on the roof. I was just wondering what your experience was. Did a lot of people check in, or were you able to see that there was radioactivity on the net, even if they didn't check in? Just wondering. It seemed very dead to me.
Well, there was a very good reason for that. This past Sunday was the third Sunday of the month. I take the third Sunday of each morning off from the 10-meter net. So it was Howard KD2MSU's net control operator responsibility. I did, though, check into what was going on 10 meters, and it was basically dead as a proverbial doornail. There was no traffic going on other than Howard. Howard didn't elicit a response from anyone in the first 5-10 minutes of the 10-meter net, and so he vacated the frequency. So it was just him for a little while and then nothing. So your antenna could be very good, and you would have gotten the same results. So I don't think your antenna was the problem. The problem was propagation, and the problem is getting people locally to come on a regular basis for the 10-meter net. This has not been the first 10-meter net on the third week of Sundays where it's kind of underpopulated.
Well, I think that explains everything, because I was not necessarily totally on time, although I've heard you go on until, 12:30, 1 o'clock sometimes with people, out and about that are transmitting when the conditions are good. So I was more than 10 minutes late, so I chalk it up probably to be more like my experience with the ARES group if I'm 10 minutes late. So I'll have to remember that and try to check in on time in the future. On the third Sunday, but I tend not to be up at 11 exactly, so it's not my first thing in mind to be running around. So to reset my schedule, I think.
Yeah, I understand entirely, William. Apparently, a lot of people don't really tune in at 11 o'clock sharp, and unfortunately, this past Sunday, because he couldn't find anyone else to talk with, he just kind of gave up and shut it down. And I don't even think he actually cleared or actually terminated the net. He just kind of said he'll try later, and I don't think he ever came back on the frequency. So it's unfortunate. It would be nice if there was more participation, and especially if people could kind of come around the time that these nets are supposed to begin. Because, net control operators, I don't think generally want to do monologues. So I certainly understand Howard's reticence to keep it alive. At least if there's a second guy, you can sometimes get something happening. But if you're all by yourself, it turns into a monologue and a broadcast. And that's not exactly what the FCC is looking for in amateur radio. So that's why every month, when we go for the general meeting, I keep pleading with people to participate on the 10-meter net, because eventually, if no one participates, then the people running it are going to get tired of it, and then it's gone.
I think that's one of the more fun things about the club, is that it's actually a group of people that are doing it routinely, because otherwise, you'd be just sitting in your shack dialing around, and you wouldn't ever have anybody you spoke to more than once, because most of these things, trying to check out people and stuff, everybody's so busy to say, oh, hi, I'm here, okay, great, what's your call sign, where are you, okay, great, talk to you next week. And so there's no real conversation going on. That's what I think is so great about the TechNet, because I think you can basically answer any question that anybody ever thought of. I don't think anybody can stump the band. And so I think at this point we'll put a challenge out there to anybody listening. Let's see if anybody's got any more technical questions for the KC2RC TechNet. Okay, this is AC2ZV. Nothing hurts. So, Roy, I heard this whole theory that the electricity doesn't go through the wire. It goes around the outside of the wire, and it doesn't actually go through at all. What do you think about that?
Okay, that's an interesting subject that I spent a lot of time on the LIMARC technical net. It's been around for the longest time. If you are a big fan of YouTube, you might have seen this Australian PhD physicist who has a channel called Veritasium. I think his last name is Muller. I don't remember his first name. And he did a whole presentation on how does electricity travel? Because the fundamental way that we all sort of learned it is that current is going in the opposite direction of electron drift, which doesn't ordinarily make a great deal of sense. Why wouldn't you draw the direction of current in the direction that the electrons are drifting? But the problem was that the arrow of current was decided upon purely by chance, 50-50. They had a 50% chance of getting it right, and they didn't. So current goes in the opposite direction of electron drift. What some people also get wrong is they have this picture of trillions and trillions of electrons traveling at the speed of light through the medium of a conductor. That's not really what goes on, unfortunately, or fortunately, who knows. But the electrons, actually, the reason why they call it drift is because they travel very slowly. Electrons will travel, inches per minute or something. So they're drifting. They're not really speeding through. So that's another problem to deal with how electricity works. And then in transmission line theory and the way that you make printed circuit boards and the way that you have to configure them for high frequency RF, you have to understand that some of the current is not traveling in the conductor. It's traveling around it in the form of electromagnetic waves. And so it's a complicated thing. And the point is that the question usually is, if I have a circuit with a load and a battery, and I make the wire a ridiculous length, but very close to each other. In other words, two parallel wires making a loop from the switch to the load on the other side of the loop of the wire, and then looping back to the power supply and the switch. When you short out the switch, how long does it take for the light to light up? Does the current travel the long distance in the loop, and when it reaches there by the speed of light, the light goes on? Well, the problem is this is also not really regular current. It's instantaneous current. Instantaneous current has slightly different characteristics than steady state current. And instantaneous current is much more likely to produce electromagnetic waves, and they don't care how long the wire is. They care the distance between the load and the battery and the switch. And so if it's a loop that loops around, it's almost instantaneous because it's traveling directly to the load. It's not going around the loop of wire that could be a distance of a planet. So that was the presentation given in Veritasium, and then there was a follow-up in Veritasium, and then there were a bunch of other guys, either with or without electrical engineering degrees, who had to talk about the subject, and it took on a life of its own.
You know, it seems to have taken on, there's this guy, I think he's in Stanford or something, that has this trellis outside with the high-tech test equipment proving that the signal, the actual wavefront goes, speed of light, or almost faster than the speed of light, before the actual electrons catch up with it, or something like that. I wasn't sure if I was following that correctly.
Okay. Nothing can really travel faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. That's not a limitation of electromagnetism. It's an inherent aspect of space-time. So nothing in space-time, no causality, can travel faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. Again, the slowest thing is the electron drifts themselves. The best way to think of how charges move in wire is to sort of think of a hollow cylinder with a lot of ball bearings in it. You push the ball bearing at one end and the ball bearing at the other end pokes out. So it's not that the individual ball bearings are traveling through the entire tube instantaneously. It's that your ball bearing at one end is pushing the other one at the other end. That's also not instantaneous because, again, causality limits the speed of anything happening to the speed of light in the vacuum. So everything is either that speed or lower. So it's a combination of those things. So the movement of charge also produces magnetic fields. Changing magnetic fields produce changing electric fields. That's electromagnetism. Electromagnetism radiates away much better than either a static electric charge or a static magnetic charge. So unfortunately, it ends up being a complicated mess. But getting back to transmission line theory, guys who build RF equipment, especially microwave RF equipment, and have to decide how to put components and ground shield them and do all kinds of things on PC boards, have to be very aware that signals do not just stay on the contacts. They will radiate on the contacts as though everything is acting as an antenna. So it's a complicated thing. It's a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but the instantaneous current from turning a switch off to on certainly does provoke electromagnetic emissions. Whether that's the case for a constant current, probably not. But that's not what the question initially was on Veritasium. It's when you hit the switch, when does the load get power? And it may not get 100% power very quickly because it's traveling the shorter distance between the switch and the load in terms of electromagnetic waves. But nevertheless, it does start out that way. So again, it's complicated and you could nitpick, but it's a kind of an interesting thing to bring up because electromagnetism is certainly an aspect of a lot of circuit design. Very few circuits are just direct current, steady current. They might be direct current in one direction, but they might be intermittent, or they might be just purely alternating currents.
Okay, thanks for that explanation. It was explained to me at one time that what was happening was the electrons are actually being burned up as heat in the load, and that's why it got hot. And I thought that was a pretty crazy idea, but then again, I tried to explain where the heat was coming from, and I'm not sure about that. So I'm wondering if you could help me out with understanding where that heat comes from in the load.
Okay. The problem is you got to be careful the way you use words. I've kind of got, at times you use slightly off words and people kind of get annoyed at me. Obviously electrons don't burn. Electrons pretty much are constant energy. Mass can't be created or destroyed except, collisions of antimatter and things like that. So electrons are always there. In your battery or your utility, the electrons are just moving. In the case of your utility, where they're cycling at 60 cycles a second, they're not even going in straight one direction. They're just kind of jumping right and left. So they're jiggling back and forth, but they're not going anyplace. But that jiggling alone is enough to produced by some energy creating object. Generators at the utility base are pumping power in to make those electrons jump to the right and to the left 60 times a second. In the case of batteries, chemical reactions are going on. Oxidation reduction. Chemical reactions are releasing electrons on one pole and drawing them into the other pole. So it's all energy. So what you're doing is you're moving electrons back and forth. It's giving up its energy to a resistance. It's converting the kinetic energy of electron movement into thermal history and energy, into a kinetics. So the electron's going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and their movement is exciting the filament of, say, an incandescent light, which causes it to get hotter and hotter and hotter until it acts like a black body radiator, and it emits light according to the temperature of the filament. The temperature of light bulbs, people talk about it very frequently, especially when you're getting equivalent LEDs. And so they talk about the temperature of the color. The temperature of the color is the temperature of a black body emitting light with that temperature. So if you take a black body and you heat it to 3,000 degrees Kelvin, it gives you the type of, it gives you a temperature light of 3,000 degree Kelvin. So that's, but nothing is burning because you're not having oxidation reduction going on in the light bulb, because if you did that, you'd consume the filament and it wouldn't last very long.
Okay, so I think the way that I could probably explain this to somebody is like you say, with these ball bearings that are, you know, in one pipe, the fact that the whole pipe is connected means that it goes round and round. If you don't have it connected, there's no way for it to go round and round. So the first thing I like about the ball bearing thing is that that's good. It shows about connectivity. The second thing I think comes out of this is that when the electrons go through the load, even though their intrinsic energy doesn't change, the force that's pushing them changes. And so then they have to go through a lot more friction, shall we say, going through the load than they do going through the wire. And so if there's more friction inside as the electrons are trying to get past whatever it is, that heats up whatever it's going through, and that in turn becomes the black body, and eventually, if there's enough friction, it broadcasts light out. So anyway, so the friction ball bearing theory seems okay to me, better than the water theory. And what do you think about that?
It's a reasonable analogy. I wouldn't kind of stick to it too hard because it's not quite the same as friction. Friction is a different aspect. Although you're moving charges, it's just primarily because the charges don't really change. You're translating the kinetic energy of moving those charges either forward or back and forth repeatedly into, you're translating that type of kinetic energy into another form of kinetic energy. Whereas instead of it just kind of going right, left, you're increasing the average kinetic energy of the filament of the light bulb. And that raises the temperature because average kinetic energy is the same thing as temperature. So the faster the individual little atoms are bouncing back and forth into each other, the higher the perceived temperature. And as the average kinetic energy increases, the black body radiation emission shifts color peaks and shifts amplitudes. So I would just say it's a translation of kinetic energy imparted in the current of the electrons, and the electrons are forced in that position because of the potential difference at both sides of the battery. You know, voltage is a potential thing. So the difference in potential from both leads of a battery will produce an electromotive force in one direction on electrons. And that's what gives you the kinetic energy that then gets translated into waste heat and light.
While you're explaining that, I came up with an even better word than friction. I think it's more like the what's happening on the atomic scale is these tiny electrons are navigating their way through this three-dimensional pathway of all these atoms with all their other electrons rotating, and it's more like a pinball machine in there, and everything is bouncing back and forth. And so the harder you push it through that pinball machine, the faster all these ball bearings bounce back and forth, and that's what lights everything up. And so I think the pinball adds a lot more to the explanation than friction.
Okay. Pick your analogy. They're all analogies, and so they're not 100% accurate, but they hopefully give people better insight into what's going on. Ultimately, the thing that determines the overall resistance of a material is its dimensions, and also whether it has localized or delocalized electrons. The whole thing that makes something a conductor and other things insulators is that conductors possess delocalized electrons. The metals in crystals have some electrons that are free to roam the lattice entirely. And so all you have to do is nudge it with a little electromotive force and off it goes. Other materials where the electrons are rather tightly bound and not free to travel are going to be insulators.
Yeah, I think we've nailed the whole ball bearing thing now. Let's go back to this field that's running around the outside of these wires. That still is somewhat defined, that the whole energy actually goes in the field outside the wire rather than traveling through it. So if we got these whole like thing going on here, how does that radiation, when the electrons get squished together, their fields sort of go out around the outside of the wire, which is creating that field because they can't move faster than the speed of light. So the harder you squish them, the bigger it goes out, which creates the higher field strength.
I wouldn't quite explain it like that. The thing is it gets a little complicated, as I mentioned earlier, that if you take the case of a incandescent light bulb, a battery, and a switch, and you turn the switch, you light up the light bulb, it's been on for an hour, there's no fluctuations in the voltage, there's no fluctuations in the current, so since there's no change in the electric field locally from the current, there's no change in the magnetic field that's produced either. Because like electromagnets, if electrical charge passes through a conductor, it also produces a static magnetic field. So those are kind of stable. They're not going to be emitted. It's only during the phase when you hit the switch and make contact that the instantaneous current is changing significantly, that you're producing a changing electric field, which creates a changing magnetic field, which produces electromagnetic waves that just generally tend to radiate from that source in all directions, isotropically, including the direction where your light bulb is. So I think I would describe it somewhat more like that.
So it seems like there's got to be a chain reaction that happens that gets the first electron to start moving all the way for the one at the other end to start moving. And that chain reaction speed is the speed of light. So, but what that also says is that as the electron is moving, the actual movement of the electron is the thing which creates that field. So in the initial state, there's got to be some form of shock wave, whatever that is. And then once we get more to the steady state that you're explaining, then you have constant movement down the wire. And so that creates the rest of the how the energy is sustained after the initial shock wave.
Okay. I wouldn't quite again call it a shock wave, because that would give some people the impression that it's traveling faster than a certain speed of the medium carrying it, which isn't the case. It's just a matter that in the instantaneous time frame, it's producing electromagnetic emissions, and in its steady state, it isn't. That would be the better explanation to me, not introduce shockwave, because then people... The problem with physics and electrical engineering and such is that physics tends to use terms that refer to something else for much more esoteric things. And sometimes that helps and sometimes that harms. Very often people will talk about electrons having an innate spin. And unfortunately, what some people think that means is that electrons are these, like the ball bearings, and like ball bearings, you can spin them. Electrons, as far as I know, are not balls. They are point charges. They are dimensionless. If you look up the dimension, the diameter of an electron, the best that you could get is a measurement that says it's less than a certain measurement, because the measuring device can only measure that small a diameter, so they tell you it's less than that diameter, which doesn't really tell you that it's dimensionless, but doesn't tell you it's not. So there's a lot of terms in physics. The spin of electron is not the same as the spin of a top or the spin of a planet. And yet, unfortunately, because physicists have decided to use that as a shorthand for some other thing that's similar but not exactly angular momentum, there's a lot of people left with the impression that things just electrons spin like tops.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to get all these analogies straight, because I've seen some of the harmonic structures that are forecast, for one electron spinning around an atom or another one spinning around an atom. And these things are not like planetary orbits. They're fields of where things might be, more likely than not. If you have two of these things, it's this kind of a design. And if there's three, it's this kind. And so, I think it's very interesting to try to visualize that stuff, but it's very hard to describe it in a way that you can explain it to anybody else. I think you're doing a great job, Roy. Anyway, maybe there's somebody else out there with some questions.
Gee, it sounds like it's just you and me. Let me just add a little bit, and then I'll make my own request. Hopefully, I could cajole someone into joining us. What you're talking about is a Schrodinger's equation, the wave equation for quantum mechanics, gives you probability a field. So something like the 1s electron, the lowest potential electron in any atom is designated 1s, looks like just kind of a hollow sphere. It's not a visualization of the electron, which again is probably dimensionless. What it is a distribution pattern of the highest probability location for an electron. So it's kind of a cloud of probability smeared across a nucleus, where the first level electron is probably more likely to exist at any one time. But let me once again repeat your request. If there's anyone out there who would like to ask an amateur radio question or any science question, we're open for business tonight, so please ID yourselves. Oh, well, it looks like it's going to be one of those nights, William. Anyway, S orbitals are relatively simple. They're kind of spherical. P's are a little weird. They look kind of dumbbell-shaped. And, of course, D's are much weirder. The only thing weirder than a D orbital would be an F orbital. They contort themselves dramatically as you go up to the higher energy levels. But again, they're not images of an electron. They're images of a cloud of probabilities of where you might find an electron.
Yeah, I get that totally. I just need to be able to take all of my ball bearings, which aren't ball bearings, and really just point charges running around inside that wire, and excite them at 28.830 megahertz, and then visualize how they're just peeling off these radiating waves out of my antenna. But then it gets even more complicated when I think of my antenna actually picking up waves from the outside, and that seems like really crazy because all of that apparently exists simultaneously within the gyrations of all of the fields coming in my radio antenna. So that is just totally mind-boggling that we have such wide parallel capability coming in from something as simple as a wire.
AC2GS, I agree with you, William. The more interesting way that I tend to look at it is most antennas that we amateur radio operators tend to use are called standing wave antennas. That's why resonance is so important to us, that they are designed in such a way that they reach the ends of the antenna elements and reflect back to the feed point, and then reflect back to the end, and then reflect back and forth. And that's why we call them standing waves, because it looks like the waves are just standing there because they're resonant. And it's kind of like anything that has a resonant frequency to it that swings back and forth and doesn't lose any energy. If it was a little longer or a little shorter, it might not reinforce the other wave correctly, and so you would lose energy as waste heat. But in a standing wave resonant antenna, you sustain that energy in many, many reflections back and forth. Electromagnetic RF energy can reflect back on standing wave antennas for hundreds of times, and each time it goes back and forth, a little bit of its energy is dissipated in emitted RF energy. And we call that a resistant-like action, radiation resistance, as opposed to ohmic or thermal resistance, in which the resistance is translated just to heat. Instead of heat, which we don't want, it's translated into radio waves, which we do want, because those are the things that we're trying to transmit to our neighbor and have it picked up on his antenna.
So the radio waves are actually generated through the electric field that's running around the outside of the wire that we were talking about earlier, and then the ohmic part is the actual electrons themselves moving back and forth inside the wire, and that's what eventually heats up the wire. So there's definitely two things going on, right?
Well, I mean, it's all part of the same thing. It's if you did not have a system of a resonant antenna, the energy wouldn't have much of an opportunity to emit electromagnetic waves and dissipate as radiation resistance. And the ultimate, since energy can't be created or destroyed, it has to go someplace. So if it can't radiate off your resonant antenna, it will simply turn into waste heat and just kind of bleed off into the environment.
Okay, well, I think that we've certainly educated the airwaves tonight on electromagnetic theory. And so I haven't even looked at the TechNet because I'm busy fiddling around. So maybe we should go to the puzzle, or maybe somebody has another topic they want to try before we move along.
AC2GS, once again, my name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month to help people with their technical questions, to discuss technical concepts as best we can, and perhaps to teach each other. So if there's anyone out there other than me and William, say hello. If you got a question, feel free to ask it. If you have a comment, feel free to make it. This is your opportunity. Yeah, William, I think your push to talk got stuck because I've been listening to you moving a little bit around there, not saying anything. So probably the push to talk was just stuck.
Yeah, I apologize for that. I noticed it myself. So anyway, hopefully somebody was trying to get in, and now I'm going to clear the frequency. Give them 15 seconds.
Nope, I think it's just you and me, unfortunately. And if you want to play the technical puzzle, I'll be more than happy to. But if you want to pass, that's okay as well.
No, I think we should do the puzzle. I'll go check it real quick, and then we'll see if somebody is going to want to try the puzzle with us. We'll see. So anyway, let's do the puzzle now.
Okay, sounds like a plan. You have to actually see it because it is a circuit. It's a very simple schematic, basically two capacitors and an inductor. The question starts, the circuit shown will, and then you're given four choices. Choice A is pass frequencies below the cutoff frequency. Choice B is pass frequencies above the cutoff frequency. C is pass frequencies above and below the cutoff frequency. And D is stop frequencies above and below the cutoff frequency. So it's basically a type of filter. And the question asks people what kind of a filter it might be.
Well, nothing heard.
Yep, like I said before, I think it's just you and me here on the airways.
Two capacitors and separated with an inductor in the middle of it. So it seems like that may be two tuned circuits. So that might be something like it has a pass band in the middle of a frequency, stop it at one level, and then it would pass a certain group of frequencies and then not pass it after that. I'm not sure which answer that is.
Okay, the problem is you got to keep in mind what inductors and capacitors do. So it's basically two sets of parallel capacitors and one series inductor. And we sort of know that the reactance of an inductor increases as frequency increases, and the reactive capacitance reactance from a capacitor goes up as frequency increases. So in DC, you're going to basically have the two capacitors do nothing. The capacitive reactance goes down as the frequency goes up. I'm sorry. So in DC, you basically have the capacitors act as open circuits, and you have the inductor act as a short circuit. And at an infinitely high frequency, you have the inductor act as an infinite impedance, and you have the shorting. The two parallel capacitors basically shorting out everything. So very, very low frequency, you get a signal. Very, very high frequency, you get a short, right?
Yeah, I see that, but it seems like if you, by adjusting the capacitors, you should be able to get it so that there's a certain band that I guess that it would pass through, but if at all low frequencies you're going to get through, then what that means is it's going to be a low pass filter, so it's going to stop all high frequencies, and that's it.
Yep, very, very true, very correct. So the correct answer would be answer A, pass frequencies below the cutoff frequency. There's no range in the middle that's optimum, where the net impedances are the lowest value and the signal goes through. It's kind of a shutoff valve. You can adjust the inductor and the capacitor to modify the shutoff frequency. Again, it's a low pass filter. By changing the capacitance and the inductance, you could move the point where it cuts off the high frequencies to higher or lower points. But it's kind of a low pass filter. The only thing that one can do with adjusting the values as of the components that are drawn into the schematic is to determine at what point and what degree you are attenuating the higher frequency signals.
Yeah, like last night I joined a junior electronics class, which was really interesting for me. And one of the reason I brought up all these subjects about what's going on and stuff like that with the electrons is because there were beginning electronic students in the class who were really struggling to come up with any kind of understanding as to what was going on. And to make matters even more interesting, what the class was about, how to make video circuits. And what we were actually doing was we're using these basic elements, resistors, capacitors, and inductors, to actually destroy the video signal so that it screwed up the TV set so that you get these great glitchy effects out of it. So I thought we were going to be actually doing something totally different in the class, but I'm in, signed up now. I'm going to find out what these people think.
Okay. Basically, it's easier to break something than to make something. So I could see where that would give you a little bit of a feedback. The problem is a lot of things in physics, short of Newtonian physics, is non-intuitive. People don't really have a good feel for it because it doesn't translate that well into the macroscopic world. And so we've been spending all these decades and centuries coming up with halfway decent analogies to try and help people kind of feel through it because, we all limit the experience. We don't see life from the point of view of a RF current traveling back and forth on a resonant antenna irradiating electromagnetic waves. And there's all kinds of complications on top of complications on top of complications. It's just not that the electromagnetic waves peel off the antenna. There's something called the near field and the far field. And the characteristics of electromagnetic waves are considerably different in the near field than the far field. In the near field, a lot of the electromagnetic waves are not in time phase. The magnetic and electric fields are not in sync. In the far field, they are. And how they go from not being in sync in the near field to being in sync in the far field is probably worth a few dozen PhD theses. So you can dive deeper and deeper and get more and more obscure. The problem is how simple do you simplify before you're basically telling people fairy tales where they might feel that they know something, but push comes to shove, it's a false thing. So that's always the problem in popularizing scientific concepts. Everyone's searching for the closest analogy where you're not asking people to misunderstand what's really going on for the sake of the happy-go-lucky feeling of thinking you know something.
Yeah, well, it's interesting with this course, the way they are approaching it, because by having, you start out with a working circuit. So you have like a video source and a TV and you have it so that they go through a breadboard. So you take it out, split it out, and run it to two rails in a breadboard. Then you have freedom to mess with the signal. And so then you start sticking components in willy nilly. And so some PDs didn't work, obviously, because they're too new. But the older ones seem to have really good sync circuits built in, so they always run no matter what. And once that happens, then whatever gets through the circuits in the tuner or into the monitor actually show up on screen, and so that glitches out all the sync and threshold circuits within this thing. And so if it rolls, that's just even better, to get that. So anyway, I find it very interesting because there's people that know absolutely nothing, playing with resistors and capacitors and, you know, getting effects that they think are cool out of it.
Okay. I would assume that they're pretty much using NTSC signals, because I would assume if they used ATSC, it would just kind of break it immediately. It, you know, digital is far less forgiving for, you know, making phase shifts and such.
Yeah, it's definitely NTSC and PAL, and there's a whole group of people that are analog video heads, and that's what they do, is they play around with different circuits and stuff and different monitors. I mean, they even go so far, a friend of mine has actually designed circuits that actually change the deflection coils in the yokes, and so then it just takes the picture and winds it around all over the screen, depending on oscillators you run in there. So obviously it's non-standard stuff, but you can put audio oscillators into the yoke circuits and play weird kind of terrible sounding music, and you get these weird designs on the TV. So that's another whole thing that's going on with all of this. So there's different groups of people that like breaking things in different ways. It's kind of interesting.
Okay. I saw a lot of that in the 70s and the 80s before the digital broadcast technology sort of took over everything. I haven't even thought of PAL in probably 10, 15 years. PAL was a big problem in that you could sometimes get a DVD that was in short supply, only to discover that it had a region code. Prior to that, you know, there were, I think, VCRs that were designed for PAL versus NTSC. So incompatibility issues, that's kind of thankfully gone the way of all things now. Most of these file formats are compatible with everything else these days, thankfully. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, it's much easier to break things than to make things. So you can do all kinds of fun stuff with an NTSC signal. You know, I mean, I still remember the bane of my existence when I was a little kid, when the TV would lose its vertical hold, and it would do that lovely little annoying roll.
Yeah, now that's an effect. you break the sync just enough that you lose the low frequency, and then it starts to roll. So, and each TV is going to respond differently. Some TVs just reject you and give you a blue screen. Other ones will let this stuff come through, and that's the thrill of it all.
Yeah, back in the NTSC days and the VCR days, one of the anti-piracy measures was a technology to introduce problems with the sync signal, so that it was just strong enough to work first generation. But if you tried to make a dub, it would further degrade the already degraded sync signal, and you'd get chroma distortion and rolls and all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah, I think we're finally coming around 360, because this is now entertainment rather than annoyance. And so that's really interesting. One thing about the 70s and 80s, though, is I saw recently Nanjun Pike thing, The Moon is the First TV on PBS. I thought that was really great and informative, and And I'd followed him for years, but I never knew that much about him. And it was really, really a great show. I wonder if you saw that.
Yeah, I saw that. And he was a famous artist. He did all of his art for a long, long time with an endlessly growing number of cathode ray tube-based televisions. He did all kinds of weird, fascinating things.
Yeah, so anyway, so lots of playing with magnetic fields there, too, with the magnets on the TVs and all that. So anyway, I think it's about time for me to turn in. Let's see if there's anybody out there with a question that's going to keep you going for a while. Otherwise, I think maybe we ought to wrap up the net.
Well, I think that kind of sums it all up, William. Thank you very much for sticking around for the TechNet tonight. Otherwise, I truly would be talking to myself. So I do appreciate it.
Well, actually, Roy, the pleasure is all mine because you're helping me remember my old electronics, and it's always great talking to you. So thanks a lot for hosting tonight, and we'll look forward to seeing you again soon.
Okay, very good, William. Thank you very much. Have a good week, and let's see, when's our next time? Well, hopefully I'll talk to you on the 10-meter net this Sunday. That's something to look forward to. So 73, and have a good week. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be June 7th, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details to log into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10 o'clock, depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net, once again, meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m., and we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m., usually on 28.380 upper sideband. We offer an audio stream of our Kings County Radio Club repeater, KC2RC, on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. You type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com, and that'll give you the audio stream. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services are generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. So we're going to roll this up now, but we'll be back June 14th, and you're welcome to join us. Thanks to William, AC2ZV. Without you, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is AC2GS going clear and getting the heck out of here. Anyone listening in, have a good week, and we'll talk down the line. This is AC2GS, and I am clear.
AC2ZV, yeah, I'm clear, too. I think this worked out great with the Echo Link, and thank you very much for hosting that, Roy, too. So anyway, talk to you again soon. 73.